Well, I appreciate Bruce had mentioned my wife in that prayer and the kindness and encouragement all of you have given to her as well as to me this week. I've had several people tell me that when my wife comes with me, I seem a little more human than I do if I just show up without my wife, and I really appreciate her willingness to come. In fact, on the way here just this morning, she said, "Don't you ever turn down any work you think the Lord wants you to do for my convenience or for my benefit." And I appreciate that very, very much. And my mother told me, said, "If you're ever overseas preaching the gospel and something happens to me and I die, don't you interrupt what you're doing to come home. It's not going to make a difference to me anyway." And that's the kind of encouragement I've had through the years, not only from good people, but from my family. And when I think of all the encouragement I've had and the kindness that's been shown me and the support I've been given, I feel like I ought to be a lot better than I am. But I do the best I can, and you folks have been such an encouragement to me this week. I think I said on Tuesday morning that I was glad you had arranged these day services. And I'm even gladder now that I see the interest that's been shown, and those of you who have attended so regularly and listened so very closely, and I appreciate that very, very much. I found it very interesting to study this series of lessons, and I hope that you find it beneficial as well. There's another lesson I might give you sometime on Christ as our conquering king. You expect that of a king, to conquer your enemies, and he has conquered all of the significant enemies that we face. He's conquered sin, and he's conquered death, and we look forward to being with him forever. And we'll say a few words about that in just a few moments. We are citizens of the kingdom of heaven, and may God help us to keep that always in mind. We're so overwhelmed by our American citizenship in some measure of patriotic spirit that we have, a love for our country, but the increasing oppressiveness of rules and laws that we have to keep because of our citizenship of this country. And it's easy for us to forget our heavenly citizenship. But we must remember that the heavenly citizenship is citizenship in a kingdom, not a democracy at all. It is ruled by a king who has all authority in heaven and in earth. Now, there are two words there that American people do not like. One of those words is authority. And I think that authority comes into more disrepute constantly. There was a time when we recognized the authority of parents, and we recognized the authority of teachers, and the teacher was the one with the ruler and the stick, and you obeyed the teacher in all circumstances. And then we respected the authority of the policeman and the authority of the president. But we've come to a time now when there is very little respect for authority. Parents don't exercise authority, and the children come nearer ruling the home than the parents do in many cases. A teacher with a stick is very much in jeopardy of retaining her position as a teacher. If she uses it, particularly, she may threaten, but she can't use it. In a private school recently, I asked the principal, I said, "Do you still paddle?" He said, "Absolutely." In a private school, you can get by with it. You'd never get by with it in a public school. There's no respect for authority. And even on a national basis, there's a certain amount of honor being given for civil disobedience, whatever that is. Violation of the law. If you don't like the law, then you have a right to get out there and protest and disobey the law, and we'll make a hero out of you because you've broken the law and maybe gotten it changed, but you broke the law. Authority is not very much respected in our country anymore, but our king has all authority in heaven and on earth. And if we're going to be citizens of the kingdom of heaven, We have to recognize authority. But the other word is king. Now, that's really, really something we don't like. I went back and read the Declaration of Independence just in connection with preparation for this lesson. And it's just a litany of complaints against King George and all the terrible things he did. And we're not going to put up with this anymore. We're going to make our own laws. We're going to establish our own authority. And the fact is that some people who are willing to submit to the authority that they have had a part in creating are not going to submit to any authority that they haven't had a part in creating. An authority that is established simply because I'm the king and I have the right to tell you what to do. Well, who gave you that right? Of course, the idea of kings through the ages has been that it was given by God. I would question that, of course, but that's the idea. By the power or by the authority of God, king over England or whatever. But we don't like kings. But that's exactly what Jesus is. When we think of kings, we tend to think of tyranny. And that certainly was characteristic of King George and of many, many other kings. In fact, that's the kind of king that Samuel warned the people they would have when they demanded a king. If you turn to the 8th chapter of the book of 1 Samuel, I don't know if you can read that or not, but we can read it out of the scripture. Beginning with verse 10, when they had insisted on a king to go before them, Samuel told the people the words of the Lord when they asked him for a king. And he said, "This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some of them to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants." That's pretty good, just a tenth, isn't it? "And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your finest young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep and you will be his servants." Well, that's a pretty dark picture, isn't it? Notice he, for his and his own interest, that's the way he will rule. Well, the first king was Saul, and that's exactly the kind of king he proved to be. He fits Samuel's description. He was indeed an autocrat. Now, not at first, but very quickly he became one. And an autocrat is defined as a domineering, self-willed person. He became very jealous of his position. And when the women began to sing, "Saul has killed his thousands and David his ten thousands," he became consumed with envy and jealousy to the point that he even tried to kill his own son because his son proved to be a friend of David. And on one occasion when the priest had assisted David in escaping, not really realizing that he was running from Saul, Saul killed 85 priests on one occasion. And his last years were dominated by his effort to try to reach, to capture David and kill him as he had, if he could have opportunity to do so. Took the little standing army that he had of 3,000 men and just constantly pursued over the country, leaving the business of the nation to fail while he was pursuing David. It said when he died that he left Israel as sheep without a shepherd. Now, that just brings to our attention the idea of sheep. God's people are spoken of as sheep all through the scriptures. And there are certain things that are characteristic of sheep. You may know a little more about this than I do, but I've had a little opportunity to observe sheep. One is that they are helpless to find their own food. They just won't get out like a dog or a cat and scramble around to find something to eat. They're just helpless. Not only that, but they're clueless when they're lost. They don't know how to get back home. Sometimes a dog will go halfway across the country, as you occasionally see in the news, to get home after it's been removed from home for some reason. But not sheep. And they're defenseless when they're attacked. They're pretty good-sized animals, but when they're attacked by wild animals, they simply cannot defend themselves. They just have to have a shepherd, therefore. They have to have a shepherd to feed them, to see to it that they have pasture. They have to have a shepherd to lead them and to seek them when they're lost. And they have to have a shepherd to defend them. And in order to have such a shepherd, someone must be found who is wise. He has to understand the sheep and their needs and what's good for them and what's bad for them. He has to know where the good pasture is. He has to be wise enough when they are wounded to know how to minister to them way out there in the wilderness somewhere, far away from a veterinarian. He has to be wise in so many ways because the sheep are totally dependent on him for everything that they need. Not only that, but he has to be brave because animals are, the sheep are attacked many times by wild animals. And he has to be able to fend off the wild animals, to defend the sheep. And certainly he has to be loving and patient. Just the idea of staying out there for days and in that land weeks at a time sometimes with the sheep, putting up with their folly and their needs. Don't you know he's sometime inclined to say, well, I just get so tired of you sheep, I don't know what to do. But that kind of person doesn't have any business being a shepherd. He has to be loving and patient to be the kind of shepherd that the sheep just must have if they're to survive. And Saul was none of these. Brave in some ways, yes, but not wise at all. And certainly lacking in love and patience. Altogether consumed with his own interests, his own selfishness. Well, under those circumstances, God rejected him as king. And he said he was going to find one after his own heart. And that servant, or that king, as you recall, was David. Now, God reminded David on one occasion, I took you out of the sheepfold. And if you remember the story, when Samuel went to Jesse's house to find a king to replace Saul, they brought the older brothers before Samuel, and he was rather impressed with one or two of them, just as he had been impressed with Saul. But God said, no, I look on the heart. I don't look on the outer man. And after all of the older brothers had been come before Samuel, Samuel said, isn't there another one? God had rejected all of them. Well, they said, there's one out there in the sheepfold taking care of the sheep out in the pasture. He said, well, bring him in. Bring him in. And so they bring in this young fellow, not impressive at all, one that humans would never think of as being a king. And God said, that's the one. That's the one. The little shepherd boy is the one God chose to be the king. And he valiantly defended his sheep even while he was out there in the wilderness with the sheep. In fact, you remember that when he was volunteering to fight against Goliath, he said that he had killed a lion and a bear with his own bare hands. He loved his sheep to the point that he was willing to risk his life, but he was strong enough to be able to defeat their enemies and to protect them as a good shepherd would do. So he was very brave and valiant in his defense and love for his sheep. The Lord said to David, according to 2 Samuel 5:2, you shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over them. Shepherd them and be a ruler over them. Here's a new kind of a ruler. Not an autocrat like Saul, but a shepherd ruler like David. He was a champion of the oppressed all through his history. Sometimes you think David made some foolish decisions, But in many, many instances, it was kind of for the underdog. And on one occasion, when he had sinned, God sent plagues on the people. And he said, surely I have sinned, and I have done wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? Let your hand, I pray, be against me and against my father's house. See the shepherd's spirit? I made a mistake. Don't punish these sheep. Punish me. I'm the one that should be the one to suffer for the mistake that I have made. That's not Saul. That's David. That's not the king. That's the shepherd, though he became the king. When you look at the history of Israel, God promised David's family an eternal throne. 2 Samuel, the 7th chapter, God made this promise to him. The nation, soon after David reigned, was divided. Now, Solomon was a little bit of a mixture. He loved the people, but Solomon worked for his own glory without any question, but that glory was reflected on the people as well, and they were proud of the ability that Solomon had to get things done, even though it was oppressive, just as Samuel had said it would be. But when Solomon's son was about to be crowned king, they asked him, will you be easy on it? He said, my little finger will be thicker than my father's loins. And he whipped you with whips, but I'll whip you with scorpions. I'm a king, and you do what I say, or you'll suffer for it. That's what he's saying. And the people rebelled. They just plain rebelled against it, and the nation was divided. All the kings in breakaway Israel were wicked, every one of them, not an exception. And even in Judah, where God had promised that the descendants of David would reign, some of them were not much better than the kings in Israel. And yet God allowed them to continue reigning because of his servant David. God respected and loved David to the point that he allowed even his descendants, who were not what they should be, to be in the line of kings. But because of the sin of the nation, eventually they were carried away into captivity. And when they were in captivity, there was no king reigning. And it just appeared that God's promise of an eternal throne for David's descendants had completely failed. And here they are in captivity, their king no longer reigning, no apparent hope for a king. And God sends a prophet. Ezekiel, the prophet, was in Babylon with the captives. It's rather interesting, and you've no doubt seen this in classes, but when the people were carried away into captivity, they were carried away in three waves, and some were still in Jerusalem while some were being carried away. And God had three great prophets. He had one prophet in the court of the king, if you can believe it. Daniel was in the king's court having communication with the king of the world at that time. Jeremiah remained in Jerusalem with those who were remaining in the city as others were being carried away. But Ezekiel went to Babylon with some of the first captives and was there prophesying, telling the people what God had in mind and what God was doing and what God would do. And in the 34th chapter, he said that God, speaking for God, I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them. My servant David, he shall feed them and be their shepherd. And I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. Now, David had been dead for 400 years. Why in the world would he say that David was going to reign over them? Well, David was just the best king they could think of. That really explains it. Someone has compared that to the description of heaven. And you talk about a street of gold and walls of jasper and gates of pearl and a river of life. I think we all pretty well understand that's not literal. But those are the things we think of when we think of just extravagant wealth and extravagant provision of the very finest of everything. And doubtless it'll be much finer than that. Someone suggested, in fact, I had a teacher one time who was talking about heaven, and he talked about the farm boy whose friend went to New York. And when he came back to New York, from New York to the farm, he tried to start explaining what he'd seen in New York. And of course, the farm boy just couldn't even comprehend it. He said, "You know that silo we've got out there?" "Yeah, I know that." "Well, they've got buildings up there. They're 10 times as tall as that silo, and people live and work in there." "Well, the Empire State Building, not just like a silo, but that's about the best the kid gets. And you know how the gopher burrows under the ground?" "Yeah, well, they've got trains that run under the ground like..." "Well, there's not much of a comparison, but that's the best the farm boy could comprehend." And I think that's weighted with heaven. And these people who were hoping for a king, the very best king they could think of was David. And so God said, "I'm going to bring David to be your ruler, your king, your shepherd." And he puts all of that together, a shepherd king. In the introduction, again, a minute ago, Bruce talked about Jesus as a shepherd and then as a king. Those of you don't think about those two things together, do you? Shepherds and kings seem to be just about as far apart as you can imagine, but God brings them together in our Lord. The David that was prophesied, of course, was a far greater king than the original David, just as heaven will be far, far better than just a street of gold and walls of jasper. 600 years later, an angel appeared to a virgin by the name of Mary, and said, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bring forth a son, shall call his name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Highest. And the Lord God will give him the throne of his father David. And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. And of his kingdom there will be no end." That's the prophecy that would be fulfilled, or that would fulfill God's promise to David. There are so many ways in which Jesus is the perfect king. In the first lesson, we suggested that God intended he would always be the king over Israel, and that any king they ever appointed was to be by his direction and was to have a copy of his law and to do his will. The king was not to be the legislator. God remained the legislator. The king was simply to see that God's laws were kept and to keep those laws himself. Well, Jesus was the perfect representative of God, to the point that he could say, "He that has seen me has seen the Father." You can't, you really can't see God. God is a spirit. But God is quality. God is love. And when you see Jesus, you see love. God is justice. When you see Jesus, you see the perfect justice of God. Every quality and characteristic of God you could see in Jesus. "So he that has seen me has seen the Father." He was more just than David. I don't remember John 5 and verse 30. Jesus said, "I can do nothing of myself. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own, but the will of the Father who sent me." Some of David's decisions really weren't totally just. But the decisions of Jesus as a judge are totally just. He is a king with all authority in heaven and in earth. David had some authority in his little realm of Israel, but not in other kingdoms. Jesus has all authority in all the earth. And David had no authority in heaven, but Jesus has all authority in heaven and in earth. He is a king in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Colossians, the second chapter, verse 3. David was wise. David was knowing, But Jesus has all wisdom and all knowledge. And he's a king who will never, never be replaced. David died, as you recall, was replaced with Solomon, who was inferior spiritually, at least, to David. And then by another son who was even inferior to Solomon. But Jesus will never be replaced. He'll always be the perfect king. And you know, when you think about it, we love a democracy, and I'm glad we have a democracy. But if you could have a king who was always wise and made perfect decisions and was not selfish at all, but ruled always for the good of his country, that would be better. Because, well, we know from our own experience that the voters don't always do the wise thing. But if you had a king who had authority and everything he ever did was wise, even far into the future, it would prove to be wise. It would prove to be the best decision possible. Well, under those circumstances, a king would be a better government until he died. And then what? Who knows? Who knows? But here is a king who is perfect in his wisdom, perfect in his unselfishness, a king who will never die. What a marvelous arrangement God has made. And of course, he is even a greater shepherd than David. Now, he knew a lot about shepherds. In fact, in the 10th chapter of the book of John, to which you might like to turn, he shows his understanding of shepherds. Now, he was not literally a shepherd while he lived here on earth, but he knew all about shepherds. He said, to him the doorkeeper opens. And this is the picture of the little sheepfolds that were out there in the wilderness. The shepherd would take care of his sheep during the day, but he had to have a little sleep also. And if he went to sleep out there with his sheep, they might wander off, or an animal might come in, or a thief, and attack the sheep. And so they had these little sheepfolds. And there would be one man in charge of the sheepfold. And the shepherds would come and bring their sheep into the sheepfold. But they even had a security problem then. Sometimes somebody would try to slip in who was not a shepherd and steal the sheep. And so the keeper of the sheepfold, the doorkeeper, had to know the shepherd. And if he knew the shepherd, then he'd let him in. If he didn't know him, oh, you'll have to go somewhere else. We can't let you in here at all. I don't think they had any kind of scanners or anything in those days. It just depended on the knowledge of the doorkeeper. And Jesus said, the real shepherd, the doorkeeper knows him and will let him in. In addition, he says that the sheep hear his voice. There's an interesting observation I've seen from several sources that sometime in that land, the sheep of several shepherds will kind of come together. Shepherd hasn't seen a human being for maybe several days, and he sees one over there with some sheep, and, hey, come over here. So the two shepherds get together, and the sheep just intermingle. And they'll talk together maybe for 30 minutes, an hour or so, and finally the shepherd says, let's go. And the other one says, let's go, or whistles or something. And those sheep will just separate, each following his own shepherd. And Jesus says, now the sheep know the voice of the shepherd who loves them, and the shepherd that they know will take care of them. He even knows the sheep well enough to call them by name. Call them by each. We know that some shepherds must have had as many as 100 sheep. Jesus speaks about that. But they knew the name of every one of them. Each name perhaps fitting the character that the shepherd had observed in the sheep. You say, surely not. Well, if you're just out there with 100 sheep all day long, you got to do something. And just as dogs are named, maybe in some cases according to their characteristics, here's Spot or here's Blackie or something. In the same way, the sheep have a name, and the shepherd knows the name of each one. And he leads them out. He doesn't drive them. He leads them out. I've had one opportunity to go to what's sometimes called the Holy Land. And One of the very pleasant experiences I had was being with a group up on the hill they call the Mount of Beatitudes. And we were up there where supposedly Jesus had spoken the Sermon on the Mount. And somebody said, "Look down there." And down there in the little valley, which was leading down to the Sea of Galilee, we saw a man coming with sheep behind him. And the farther he came, the longer the line became. And there must have been at least 50 sheep, maybe more, following along single file behind the shepherd. There was the shepherd leading his sheep, and they were just following because, well, they had confidence in him. They knew he was leading them to the right place, to a place that would be beneficial. They knew that by experience. And not only that, but it says he goes before them. And they knew that if there was a lion out there, or a bear, or a wolf, that he would meet that animal first and be able to contend with it and to defend them. Not only that, but they follow him and they know his voice. And in all of these ways, they show their love for them. Now, after describing all that, Jesus says, "I'm the good shepherd." Now, that just means that Jesus understood all of these characteristics of a shepherd, and he claimed to fulfill those characteristics. The doorkeeper opened to him. Who are the doorkeepers? Well, I'm not sure, but the general idea, and I think it's probable, are the prophets. The prophets had foretold one who was coming, and if someone came and didn't fit the description of the prophets, and John the Baptist, for example, then they would not have been accepted. But John the Baptist, if you want to think of him as a doorkeeper, recognized Jesus, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world. This doorkeeper recognized and acknowledged Jesus. Not only that, but his sheep hear his voice. We talked the other night about those men who met him first down by the River Jordan. They heard a voice that appealed to them, that they heard a voice that they knew was a voice of love and a voice of wisdom and a voice of divinity. "You're the Son of God," Nathanael said. And they began to follow him. Not only that, but he called his own sheep by name. He knows them by name, and he leads them out. That is, he doesn't ask them to do anything he doesn't do. He doesn't ask them to climb a hill that he's not willing to climb. He doesn't drive them into danger that he's not willing to face. And in fact, he goes before them to deal with any spiritual enemy that they may have to face. That's the kind of shepherd he is, as well as being a king. He went beyond what many shepherds would go, because he says the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Now, hirelings that don't actually own the sheep are going to run. I just confess, if I was hired to keep a group of sheep and was attacked by a lion or a bear, I'd say, "Bye-bye, sheep, I'm running." That would be my disposition. But the shepherd who owns the sheep loves those sheep to the point that he's willing to die for them. And this shepherd did die for his sheep. Not only that, but he says, "I know my sheep. The Lord knows those that are his." I don't always. I've made some mistakes thinking certain individuals belong to the Lord when really they didn't. But he knows. He knows in this congregation. He knows. I would just tend to think that people who come to a morning service, of course there's some others who would like to be here, but people who are interested enough to come to a morning service are more likely to be the Lord's sheep than those who just come on Sunday morning. Maybe because their wife expects them to, or their parents expect them to, or whatever, for whatever reason they may come. The Lord knows. The Lord knows. And I mentioned, Sunday morning, that I believe some more divisions are ahead of us. I believe churches are going to be divided. And it's a sad thing to see a church divide. I've experienced seeing churches that I dearly love, the people, separating, getting angry with one another. They sometimes call me and from both sides and want me to take sides. Well, each person that calls me tells me his side of it. He tells me how he sees it, but may leave out some little fact that is very, very important. I get that from the other side, but he doesn't tell it all. And you just think, it's like a death. It's like seeing someone in the hospital dying, and here's a church that you love. But the consolation is, the Lord knows those that are his. And those who truly love the Lord are going to stand for what's right. Sometimes they can stay and others leave. Sometimes they have to leave. But the Lord knows those that are his. We need to be not to ourselves make too quick a judgment. I think sometimes we do. And drive off people that somebody said sometime we skin sheep looking for wolves. And we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. But there are wolves that come in sheep's clothing, but the Lord knows who they are. And in some great measure, the Lord takes care of a situation. I think if we just let him do it, that he'll take care of that kind of situation. As long as we do our very best to exercise his nature and his character. And he says, I'm known by my own. There are many that don't know the Lord. But those who truly know him are his people. Behold your king, a shepherd king. As a shepherd, he knows you even by your name. As a shepherd, he leads you in the path of righteousness. You know where he leads you is where you need to go. It may not appear that way at times. The world around you will think you're going in the wrong direction. They'll ridicule you sometime. But if you're following your shepherd, you know it's the right way to go. He provides for you that living bread. Man shall not live by bread alone, that is by earthly, physical bread, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. And the words of Jesus are the words of the Lord. And this is the bread that will sustain us spiritually and cause our inner man to be spiritually strong. He goes before us, facing every enemy first. And I suspect we would be just a little bit surprised if we knew how many enemies the Lord has actually defeated before us without our being aware even of what he was doing. He teaches us to pray, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And the proper translation probably is the evil one. That's suggested by many scholars. Protect us. Does God protect us? The 1 Corinthians letter 10 verse 11, I believe it is one of the most comforting verses to me in all. The Lord is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted beyond what you're able to bear, but will with the temptation provide the way of escape. I sometimes have faced temptations, and I thought, I just don't know if I can endure this or not. I don't know if I can resist it or not. And then I remember, well, the Lord believes I can, because if he didn't believe I could resist it, he would not have let it come. If that verse says anything, that's what it says. He will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we're able to bear. And so when we're tempted, the Lord believes we can overcome it, knows we can overcome it. Well, he doesn't just believe. He knows we can overcome it, and that's the only reason to let it come. And if we resist it, it'll be for our good, because what he allows to happen is always for our good if we react as we should react. That's such a valuable lesson to us. But he knows us and he knows our needs. And he's already given his life for us. It's not simply wondering if he's willing. He's already proved his willingness to do it. And he'll lead us into the eternal fold of safety. He's the only shepherd that knows the way. Jesus said, a stranger they will not follow. And it seems to me we use a lot of passages, I think, correctly. 2 John 9, whoso goeth onward and abideth not the doctrine of Christ hath not God. We must do just what he says and nothing more. And Hebrews 7, of which Moses spoke nothing concerning priesthood, and that meant that no one could serve of any other tribe. And when Jesus came from the tribe of Judah, since Moses had not said anything about a priest from the tribe of Judah, the silence of Moses was so eloquent that in order for Jesus himself to be a priest, the law had to be changed. Why? Because it didn't say anything about a priest from Judah. We use that passage. But you know, that's no stronger than this one. A stranger they will not follow. Everything Jesus wants us to know, everything that pertains to life and godliness, is here. This is the voice of the shepherd. And when someone comes who may appear to be such a wonderful, wonderful shepherd, so loving, so gentle, so kind, and begins to tell us that we need to do this or need to do that, or, well, where's the shepherd said? Now, if I can't find it in the shepherd's voice, either directly while he was here on earth or as he spoke through his apostles, this must be a stranger. That stranger may be ever so good conscience himself, ever so sincere. But if it's not here, it's a stranger. And if I'm the sheep of the Lord, I'm listening for his voice, and I'm not going to follow the voice of a stranger. In Revelation, the 7th chapter, I'd like to turn to that. The thought is that this great king, who was great when he was on earth, and who claimed all authority in heaven and in earth, and then was ascended to God, and was recognized by the angels, and sat down at the right hand of God, is still a shepherd. What a beautiful thought to me. Beginning with verse 13. John is describing his vision. And one of the elders answered, saying to me, who are these arrayed in white robes? And where did they come from? And I said to him, sir, you know. So he said to me, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation, washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them. They shall neither hunger any more nor thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them nor any heat. Now why is it they're not going to be hungry? Why is it they're not going to be thirsty? Why are they not going to be affected by the heat of the sun? The Lamb who is in the midst of the throne shall shepherd them. A shepherd with the very spirit and heart of a lamb will be the shepherd of the sheep and will lead them in all his wisdom and all his greatness with all his love, even in the eternity that lies before us. He will shepherd them, lead them to living fountains of water. God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Bruce, that brings together this idea of an exalted king who in one sense steps down from the throne to shepherd his people. And I believe he's doing that now. And he certainly will continue to do it. For Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that spirit of a shepherd does not change. Why be a Christian? That's what we're talking about at night. But I wish there's some way. You people will appreciate these thoughts that many visitors would never grasp. And that's one of the things I like about a morning service. You can just get into things that the spiritually minded people will comprehend and understand. And Why be a Christian? Is there any better reason than that Jesus called us? Jesus called us over the tumult of this world's, I thought I could quote it, but I could sing it, but I'm not going to trouble you with that. But Jesus called us, and his sheep, you know his voice. His sheep hear his voice. And we determine whether we will be sheep to hear his voice or whether we will reject his voice, be sheep of another shepherd. May God help us to stand for what. Let's turn to that song and we'll just read it. Well, we can sing it if you want to. Where is it? Jesus calls us. Oh, let's see. What's that? 325? 225. That's the reason I can't teach class as much. I can't hear anymore. All right. Let's just sing that. 225.